Welcome to the Sourcing Hero podcast, produced by UNA, a group purchasing organization that empowers sourcing heroes, and Art of Procurement, the world's largest procurement podcast network. I'm your host, Kelly Barner. The goal of the Sourcing Hero podcast is to capture the epic stories of people who are rising up and beating the odds to create exceptional value within procurement, directly from those heroes themselves. Today, my guest on the Sourcing Hero podcast is Helen McKenzie. Helen has been a friend of mine and Philip Eidson's for a long time, but in 2021, she officially became a member of the Art of Procurement team. With a background in procurement strategy and public procurement policy development, she brings a really unique perspective and, of course, enthusiasm to our field. So, hi, Helen. Thank you so much for being here with me today.
It's an absolute pleasure, Kelly. Lovely to join you.
Now, anybody that is connected with you or has engaged with you, especially on LinkedIn, knows that you are madly in love with procurement. But can you share a little bit more about your specific background and experience?
Okay, I think like a lot of people, I started my work life in accountancy, in accounts. I was good at maths, so I thought that was a great place to start. And, you know, I'm somebody that quite likes the right answer for things, so it sort of appealed to my logical side. And I did that for a while, but then I got the opportunity to flex the creative side of my brain in a policy job. It was at the time when the Scottish Parliament here was established. There was a lot of policy work to be done. And, you know, I was one of the people that got stuck in to do that. And that was great because that was thinking great thoughts about how we might achieve outcomes in society. So I worked for government. But what was quite frustrating about policy was that you could write all those great words, but you couldn't actually get your sleeves rolled up and get stuck in and make things happen. So I got the opportunity to go back to financial services. I got quite a senior role in that field, and back I went. But during my time in policy, I'd had a little bit of an encounter with procurement. And, you know, it's a bit like a slow burner. I saw it. I thought, procurement, that's quite interesting. It feels to me like the intersection between this thinking great thoughts and making things happen. You know, I wonder if I might come across it again. And fortunately for me, the opportunity came to head up procurement in the organisation I was working in. So I grasped it with both hands, and my love affair with procurement started then. I think the other thing to say at that point, I also discovered on a podcast a man from Skipton who captured my attention once a week, and I became an Art of Procurement listener at that point. And, you know, couldn't live without the episodes and couldn't have done a lot of the procurement work I did without Phil and all that insight way back when.
Well, we certainly love hearing about Art of Procurement addictions. That's, I think, a healthy thing for everyone. If you're going to be addicted to something, definitely consider being addicted to Phil's podcast. And it's so funny because, you know, listening to you talk about going into accounting, I think if I had known you back then, I probably would have said, oh no, Helen, please don't do that. There's so much more you can bring than accounting. But to hear you talk about sort of the logical side of your approach and wanting to look for the right answer, it's such a contrast from when you discuss individual topics and bring to light your perspective on procurement. I went back through some of your posts and your LinkedIn profile, and the words that jumped out at me were love, passion, drive, change. So obviously you have this solid background in policy and financial controls, but I think probably your greatest strength is that you're able to combine those two in slightly different mixes for the certain circumstances. Do you consciously think about bringing sort of the logical and the creative together when you address these topics?
Well, I think so, yes, because I think that how I see procurement is being the bridge between the sort of financial processy control side of things and the creative side of things that is policy and procurement. It's that bridge between it. And you can't have one without the other, I don't think. So in order to be imaginative, in order to really get in there and serve the stakeholders' needs, you need to be really confident about your sort of core processes, the way you do things, yes. Your contracts, your your procedures, your governance, and so on. So I think the financial side of things gives me that sort of view of the world that's about rigor and about doing things properly. But then you can lay on top the sort of more wacky creative side of things. And actually, it's liberating. If you know that you've got that that practice and that discipline that underpins everything you do, then you can actually be quite passionate and be quite, quite ambitious about what you want to achieve, because you know that you're going to do it correctly and you're not going to, you know, make a mistake around that side of things. So that's how I see it. It's procurement at being that bit in the middle that balances the imagination and the passion of policy with the financial control governance side on the other side of the sort of seesaw, and the balance is what we need to be like.
Well, and when you talk about having that discipline, it's interesting because you think about people that focus on discipline and governance, right, and really the control side of things, but you've positioned it as having discipline around the things that have to be or have to be a certain way so that you are free to be creative with everything else. It's so the discipline becomes sort of a foundation, and then making the conscious decision to bring an imaginative approach or think outside the box in to create additional value. That actually brings us around to what we're predominantly going to talk about today, which is being intentional. And I think being intentional is a very specific way of working. So we've talked about discipline versus creativity. How would you differentiate being intentional from sort of straightforward things like, well, I just follow the plan, or I'm just getting my work done, or, you know, oh, an opportunity came along and so I took it? How would you actually describe or define being intentional in your work?
Well, I think being intentional does need creativity. But it does need a structure around it, like I've just said about that enabler. And I think if you just follow a plan, you know, I've got my plan, my steps to do a sourcing process, the way I always do things, and I tick my boxes, you close down that opportunity to deviate, to improve. And if you've got an intention like you want to make sure that a bigger range of suppliers are involved in a sourcing process, so you've got a broader choice, then you've got to be quite intentional about how you might go about that. So just following a plan and getting to the end and saying, well, we only had two, but we followed the process, you know, that's old school procurement and that's quite structured. So I think that opportunism can come from the other side of the coin, is being opportunistic. It's just saying, well, let's go and see how we're going to do it. And, you know, something might come up and then something comes up and off you go. And there was no plan. And you end up sort of not knowing how you're going to implement it because you're the other way. You're so freestyle that, you know, somebody, I don't know, a supplier gets in touch and you have a call and you get excited about the prospect and you think you might implement it. And that sort of opportunism doesn't sit itself in any structure. So I think to be intentional, you've got to, well, first of all, understand where you're going. And secondly, have that structure around it. And I'll give you a little example to bring that to life. So we had a process where we were looking to put new contracts in place for bus services. And our intention was that we wanted to involve the people that we served more in the process. So we would call that community engagement. So we wanted more community engagement in that procurement process. So we needed to have a plan because we needed to know where we were going with it. But we needed also to build in an approach that had some flexibility to get those opportunistic things that might happen on the way and being able to include them, but also to think about risk when we got there. So it was quite, because that was our intention at every step of the way, we were saying, well, how does what we're doing achieve that objective? And if it doesn't, you know, we need to think through how can we make it achieve that? Because I think with something quite different or something quite challenging, it's very easy to just sort of back down and say, oh, well, you know, these things happen and we just couldn't do it. So back to my example about getting more suppliers involved. Oh, well, we put the word about, but we didn't get enough people engaged in the process. Never mind. Rather than saying, you know, we are going to achieve this. How can we do it? What might come up? And you know, trying to factor that into the process. So we did that. We were very intentional that we wanted it to happen. It wasn't easy. Perhaps talk about the challenges in a minute. But our intention was always to do that, and we made it happen. And I think that that's something where the sort of planning and rigor, so doing some scenario planning, well, what if we need to, it doesn't work and we need to do it again? What if the people don't buy into what we're doing and we need to get them more involved? What if the stakeholder doesn't want to take the risk? What if the process comes out and it's more risky at the end? How can we design those things in to actually create a roadmap so that our intention can be achieved? And I know you're talking a lot at the moment about supplier diversity, and I think that there needs to be, you know, if that's people's intention, you know, they just don't need to say it. I think they need to really think through, we're going to make this happen. How's that going to work? And what is the process going to be?
Well, and also I hear you saying is that you had this intent, but it wasn't just because you had decided, okay, this is going to be our strategy, and so we need to do absolutely everything we can to make this happen. It was because you so truly understood and supported the why behind that intent that you were able to alter your approach, alter your strategies, keep reaching out to people, because it wasn't just, well, this was the plan and we don't want to deviate from the plan. It was, this was the plan because this other objective or value or goal was so incredibly important to us, that getting that additional community engagement, that was your driving force, which allowed you to stay fixed on what you were trying to get done, simply because such a valuable set of input was going to be missing from the project otherwise. And that may have sort of helped you stay on track because that why was such a driving factor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, you know, sometimes that why comes from, you know, a policy that's been approved in your organization that you're required to follow. So your why is, well, that's the way that our organization wants to do things like that. And that's possibly around things like sustainability, where that's can be quite challenging, but the why is there. But yes, you're absolutely right. And I think that just understanding that there will be obstacles and there will be challenges and it won't be easy but the intention is to make it happen. It is useful. You know, I think that back to my example, there was, you know, quite some quite interesting challenges to overcome, which I think when we talk about intention and people want to perhaps generalize out what I'm saying, you know, something around risk, contract management risk. So the intention to, use a smaller supplier or a more diverse supplier in a contract, well, the pushback might be that the contract management around that's going to be more intensive because they're not as experienced or they're not used to that. So, you know, how do we overcome that challenge? How do we talk through that with the stakeholder or whoever's involved in the process? Or doing something different or new might take more time. We certainly had that in our bus process, that we thought it might not take, it might take more time, and it certainly does when you involve people in the process out in the community, or that the first time we did it might not work and we might have to iterate and do it again. So we had to think about time, and time was a bit of a challenge because there was only so much time to do it. So that was another one. And I think the other one's about resistance to change, or resistance to the intention that you're trying to implement. You know, some people might be skeptical, even though you might be really,
of course,
you know, signed up to the why. Other people might be skeptical about that. So, you know, how do we hear those concerns from our stakeholders, but also work through with them why that objection, I suppose, might not be as bad as they think, or might not even be valid, or what we might do to mitigate the risk that they might quite rightly raise around something like that. So there's something around trying to overcome obstacles as well that I think we need to be really clear about. It's not all about, you know, me just getting really enthusiastic and rah, 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 on we go. That nothing that's important but difficult happens without actually trying to overcome those challenges. And so, you know, back to that idea at the beginning about the foundation and the creativity, part of the foundation about being intentional is trying to sort of think through as much as you can all the things that might go wrong on the way, so that you've actually anticipated some of them, most of them, and try to work through what you would do if that's gonna happen, or even work out a way to avoid them happening in the first place.
Well, and I think it's fair to talk about the challenges, right? I love that point you just made, that nothing that is important comes to pass without overcoming obstacles. I think all of us grownups living in the real world know that that's 100% true, absolutely all of the time. But I also imagine that the successes and the victories and the results associated with taking an intentional approach make that effort to get past the obstacles more than worthwhile. Can you share some of the types of successes that you've had over the years taking an intentional approach?
Well, yeah, I'd love to. And this will let me get all excited and passionate about it.
So, but you just told us we weren't supposed to listen to you if you got all excited. So we're giving everybody a pass. Helen's excited, but this time we're going to listen.
Oh, good, good. Well, yes. Okay, so, I mean, one example is very, you know, very straightforward example. We had a contract for cutting the grass that was done by a very big supplier that wasn't based locally. And we wanted to see if we could, when we ran the sourcing exercise, see whether we could encourage smaller businesses to bid for that work and, you know, potentially win if they were the best option for the contract. So we had to overcome the obstacle of the colleagues that were running that contract worrying about the contract management. We had to think about the way that we structured the specification for that contract so that it wouldn't put people off tendering for it. And we did that. We went out, we repackaged the contract into slightly smaller chunks. So it wasn't one big one, it was five little ones, and two small suppliers won the contract. And that was just wonderful because at the end of it, our intention was achieved, but we had to do a lot of work on the way. So that's one. I've talked about the buses, so I don't think I will talk about that anymore, just to say that, you know, that the success of that in us trying to do something new, iterating and making it work, was something that we, you know, were asked to talk about far and wide, from Hong Kong to the United States to lots of places in the UK. So, you know, us trying to do something new, you know, was proved to be really inspirational for other people. So that was a great win. The final one I wanted to talk about, and I think I covered this in a post on one of your LinkedIn contributions last week, Kelly, was around putting something into a contract so that a business that employs people with disabilities actually got the work. So what we did there was we we wanted to, our intention was to involve that business. We looked at how we might do that. Could we split the contract or could we do something else? And we ended up specifying in the contract that the main contractor, so it was a building contract, and it was the company made doors, fire doors and doors. And we specified in the contract that they needed to use them. And, you know, some people said, oh, well, Helen, you know, you put that in, it's going to, the contract's going to cost more, because when you looked at the price of the doors compared to the price of other doors, they were more expensive. But what happened was the contractor just absorbed that requirement into their pricing, and there was no impact other than we achieved that objective, which was to put a considerable amount of work through the main contractor to that small supplier that employed that group of people. So, you know, that was a great win. And sometimes when you think about an intention, the route to the end isn't always, you know, just put it out and see if they win. There are other ways that you can do it. So that one was I like that one because that's a little bit different. And, you know, it's not just about how you split the contract or what you put in your contract terms. But yeah, there's some examples for you there.
And sometimes it does take a different kind of effort, right? Being intentional, you know, as we've talked about, is not as straightforward as just following a plan or even being clear on your why, that if it's really forcing you to sort of flex your creativity muscles, you may have to change the discovery process or the analysis process or the RFP process or how you give feedback to suppliers, and being mm-hmm. open to that to ultimately get to the goal that you've chosen may require a different kind of effort. Now, Helen, if you're ready, we've come to the point in the conversation where I want to ask you what I think is a very tough question, but it's a question that I ask absolutely everyone who joins me on The Sourcing Hero. And that is, what does the idea of a sourcing hero mean to you? Or what is heroism in a business context? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think when I was thinking about this, I was thinking who epitomizes a sourcing hero to me. And it brought to mind a woman that I used to work with called Kathleen. And, you know, Kathleen epitomized heroism in sourcing because, first of all, she was really customer focused. She always put the stakeholders first. So, you know, if one of them phoned at 4:30 on a Friday afternoon with a requirement, you know, she always took a deep breath and said, okay, well, how can we help you? She would never push back and tell them to wait till Monday. So I think there's something about understanding that a stakeholder won't come and demand things at unreasonable times of an unreasonable speed unless there's some imperative on their side that's got them into that position. So there's something about customer first, stakeholder focus that's good for me. She also knew her processes inside out. And I think, you know, to be heroic, we need to be confident. And to be confident, we need to build that on those strong foundations that I've talked about throughout. So, you know, really strong knowledge of the subject matter, knowledge of how we do great procurement. And I think the final thing is willingness to go the extra mile. And I know that, you know, not just about 4:30 in the afternoon requests, but also, you know, getting on the phone, trying to find the supplier. And I know a lot of colleagues will have done this during the pandemic, of trying to find sources of supply for all sorts of things. So understanding that, you know, to be heroic sometimes means just working really hard. And I think that that's something that obviously a lot of us in procurement have done and will do and carry on doing. But there's something about understanding that sometimes getting a result is just about doing the work. It's just about doing the work. So yeah, there's my heroism there for you in those three things. And as I say, you know, my former colleague Kathleen just embodies that. And she was a fantastic colleague to work with and learn from.
Well, we're always lucky to have contact with people that, you know, give us approaches or attributes that we can mirror, right? People that are truly good examples. But I also have to say, I really like the honesty of your point about sometimes heroism is about just showing up and getting it done. Because mm-hmm. sometimes even that is hard and people aren't going to make it happen. So I'm always amazed at the range of perspectives I get from people. I feel like that's a particularly critical component to business heroism, because I think it's something that all of us can do, right? Show up and do the job, even when it's hard or you're tired or it's more complicated than usual. That makes it feel so much more achievable to go that extra mile. And I think that's an important idea around heroism to have reflected in the conversation. So Helen, thank you so much for being here with me and for joining everyone that listens to the Sourcing Hero podcast to share your perspective. If people are interested in engaging with you on social media, which I highly encourage, Helen makes great candid videos that are as entertaining and gorgeous from a landscape perspective as they are informative and enlightening around procurement. What is the best way for people to get in touch with you?
Well, as you said, I'm on LinkedIn. I've got a handle, Superstar Helen, which comes from my past life. If you look on my LinkedIn profile, you'll find out. So I'm Superstar Helen on Twitter. I'm on LinkedIn. Just Google me, Crazy in Love with Procurement. And obviously, of course, at Art of Procurement as well.
And it's probably poor manners to correct a guest, but Helen, for the record, being a superstar is not just part of your past experience. You continue to be a superstar today, and we are thrilled that you're part of the team at Art of Procurement.
Thanks, Kelly. That's great coming from someone like you. Thank you very much. And it's a joy to work with you. And thanks for having me on the podcast.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Sourcing Hero podcast. Join us again next time for more true stories of sourcing and business heroism performed by your colleagues and peers. Look for The Sourcing Hero wherever you get your podcasts, and don't forget to subscribe. Finally, don't forget, sourcing heroism is taking place all around us every day. Keep your eyes open and you're bound to see it. Until next time, I'm your host, Kelly Barner. Stay well, and always remember that you can be a hero too.